Kyiv and Washington appear ready to make a deal.
It's a mineral deal where basically the U.S. and Ukraine will jointly develop their mineral resources, and that includes oil and gas.
The man likely to be Germany's next chancellor warns that times are changing.
And we now find ourselves in a difficult position to organize the transition away from U.S. being the leading provider of security to a more European-driven approach.
And Israel increases its military footprint in the West Bank.
The month-long operation in the northern West Bank has been one of the biggest since the second Intifada Palestinian uprising more than 20 years ago. For the first time in decades, Israel has deployed heavy battle tanks there.
Today is Wednesday, February 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was in Kyiv last week to discuss a rare earth minerals deal as Ukraine vies to win the backing of U.S. President Donald Trump at a perilous diplomatic juncture in their war with Russia. News broke late Tuesday in Washington that Kyiv will accept a deal with the U.S. and that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will visit with President Trump in Washington on Friday. For more, I'm joined by our White House correspondent, Anita Powell.
So what we're hearing is that this is a framework of a deal. It's not a deal until it's signed by both parties. Here's what we know, though, with all of that said. This is a deal without explicit security guarantees at this time. It's a mineral deal where basically the U.S. and Ukraine will jointly develop their mineral resources, and that includes oil and gas. And the idea is that 50% of future proceeds from new projects will go into a fund controlled by the U.S., but only for investing in Ukrainian projects. So it's a joint venture that basically allows the two countries together to explore untapped resources of oil, gas, and rare earth minerals.
So why is it in Ukraine's interest to sign this? What's it in for them?
Well, this is an investment deal in Ukraine. And the deal stipulates that this has to be invested into Ukraine's economic development, which answers the, you know, it fits the bill for what Trump has been saying all along with giving money to Ukraine. His argument all along has been if the U.S. is going to keep paying for Ukraine's continued, you know, one could argue survival, but continued ability to support its government, non-military support, then Ukraine's got to front something for it.
And turning that same question around the other way, what's in it for the U.S.?
Well, this does give Trump something to take in return. He gets to show a payoff. He gets to at least talk about a payoff and say, you know, we've signed a deal to exploit their mineral resources. That's going to return something to the American people. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about exploration of resources, not known resources, and what they can get to in a country that is bedeviled by war. You know, what the terms are going to be, who's going to lay claim to what parts of Ukraine. We still haven't settled what the current borders of Ukraine are. So there's so much about this deal that could be complicated by reality on the ground. But Trump at least gets to say, I'm not giving away something for nothing, which has been his entire contention all along.
There was also reporting today that Vladimir Putin said he would be interested in an economic deal with the United States as well. Have you heard anything about that?
Right. And Trump said something about that just now in the Oval Office, that he's not averse to that idea, that he'd like to invest in Russia as well. So and that, of course, was part of the talks when negotiators went to Saudi Arabia to negotiate with Russian officials. And there they inked some agreements to look at future economic plans together. So that could be part of that. And that's not really unexpected.
So last question, is there any idea when we can expect a public announcement on the final terms of this deal between the U.S. and Ukraine? And we get to see what all has been happening behind the scenes.
Well, I would not be confident about that until the Sharpie drags over the paper and Donald Trump signs this deal. I think a lot is in flux. And this is, you know, we've seen in the last 4 weeks, Donald Trump's his negotiating style, where he comes in swinging and he goes big at the start. And at the end of the day, he walks away with something that, as Carolyn Leavitt said today on the White House podium, both sides are a little bit unhappy with. So he might be making these large offers and negotiating in public, knowing that he won't get everything he's asking for.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the program when the Sharpie drags over the paper, as you said. VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Powell. Anita, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, elsewhere in Europe, Friedrich Merz, who will likely be the next chancellor of Germany after gaining the largest vote share in elections on Sunday, has warned that the United States does not care much about the fate of Europe and has called for the continent to urgently organize its own defense capability. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the comments mark a profound shift coming from Europe's biggest economy.
The Brandenburg Gate, once the frontier between East and West Berlin during the Cold War, was lit up Monday in blue and yellow, marking the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The renewed threat from Moscow formed the backdrop to the German elections on Sunday, won by the centre-right Christian Democrats. Jürgen Harker was among those attending the demonstration in front of the Brandenburg Gate.
I hope that the new government will continue to supply weapons to Ukraine, that it will work together with the European states to develop a major counterweight to Russia, and now also to Trump.
U.S. President Donald Trump has overseen a dramatic change in U.S. policy on Ukraine, recently blaming Kyiv for starting the war. Washington has said European security is no longer a priority. After his victory in Sunday's German election, the Christian Democrats leader Friedrich Merz said the Trump administration, quote, does not care much about the fate of Europe.
It is clear that we Europeans must now be able to act very quickly, and that we must also organize our own defense capability very quickly.
Das ist ein Thema, das absolute Priorität hat in den nächsten Wochen.
Merz is a strong supporter of transatlantic ties, and his words mark a seismic shift for Germany and Europe, says analyst Mattia Nellers.
We are, as Germany, shocked by the end of the, and utterly unprepared for the end of the Pax Americana, the end of America providing security for Europe. And we now find ourselves in a difficult position to organize a transition away from US being the leading provider of security to a more European-driven approach, not just to Ukraine, but to organizing our own self-defense. But Merz has said he's willing to lead on that. And let's see whether we are able to step up.
Can Europe afford to pay for its own defense? Merz will have to change his fiscal stance, says analyst Liana Fix.
He can agree to joint debt on the European level, which the Conservatives always hated. And he can agree to seizing Russian force assets, which has not been done so far, but should be done soon. He has talked about the UK and France having to extend the nuclear umbrella to Germany as a possible pathway.
The Christian Democrats are well short of a majority. Merz has ruled out forming a coalition with the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, which came second with a record 20.8% in the Sunday vote. The centrist party's so-called firewall around the AfD has been strongly criticised by Washington. AfD co-leader Alice Weidel.
We consider this blockade to be undemocratic. You cannot exclude millions of voters per se.
Instead, Merz is to begin coalition talks with the Social Democrats of outgoing Chancellor Olaf Scholz. In addition to defense spending, cutting migration and boosting Germany's ailing economy will likely dominate the discussions. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Back in Washington on Tuesday, the White House announced it would decide which journalists get access to President Donald Trump's events, stripping the power from an independent association of media outlets that has done so for around a century. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said that the White House Correspondents Association, or the WHCA, should no longer have a monopoly over choosing the members of the pool. That's the small group of reporters who cover Trump in places like the Oval Office and Air Force One. The WHCA swiftly condemned the move, saying it tears at the independence of a free press. Levitt revealed the move at a daily briefing, saying that the WHCA dictated which journalists get to ask questions of the President of the United States. She said that legacy outlets would still be allowed to join the press pool, but that access would also be opened to deserving outlets who have never been allowed to share in this awesome responsibility. WHCA President Eugene Daniels criticized the decision, saying that this move tears at the independence of a free press in the United States. It suggests the government will choose the journalists who cover the president. He added, in a free country, leaders must not be able to choose their own press corps. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Pope Francis was in critical but stable condition Tuesday, with no new respiratory crises as he worked from the hospital while still battling double pneumonia. The Vatican's evening update said the 88-year-old Pope underwent a follow-up CAT scan, but provided no details of what it showed. An unknown illness, first discovered in three children who ate a bat, has rapidly killed more than 50 people in northwestern Congo over the past 5 weeks, health experts say. The interval between onset of symptoms, which include fever, vomiting, and internal bleeding, and death, has been 48 hours in most cases. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. In American domestic politics, ongoing freezes in federal funding are affecting the agricultural industry. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more from the Midwestern state of Wisconsin.
Farmer Andy Hatch grows and produces what the state of Wisconsin is famous for.
Cows and cheese. It's really what, you know, built our state and still is a hugely important part of our economy. $45, $46 billion impact on our state.
A key source of Hatch's income is a specialty cheese that ages on racks in his facility.
It will age for about a year before we sell it. It's in here biding its time, becoming delicious.
To compete with European cheese producers that are heavily subsidized by their governments, Hatch needs to upgrade and expand.
To be competitive, we need support from public institutions, from the government.
Hatch turned to the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, for funding.
We applied for and were awarded federal funding through the NRCS. And that funding was meant to cover about 25% of a project that will stretch over $1 million.
Hatch had already spent about $50,000 on designs for modern, environmentally friendly facilities for housing and feeding cows that produce milk for cheese. When he received notice in January that funding for USDA conservation projects was frozen.
We've not started construction, and we won't until we're sure that the funding we were promised is going to come through.
We're not getting paid or reimbursed for work that we have done.
Joe Tamandel is executive director of the Dairy Grazing Alliance, which also depends on USDA funding for a variety of projects, including apprenticeship programs intended to train a new generation of dairy farmers and agricultural workers.
We understand, you know, the objectives of the administration and coming in and making sure that there isn't any abuse of the systems. We just hope that we're not an unintended consequence of it, because, you know, we really align with what this administration is looking at doing.
Uncertainty is the biggest risk for all actors in the agricultural supply chain.
Andrew Stevens is an assistant professor of agriculture and applied econometrics at the University of Wisconsin. He says even if funds begin to flow again, farmers will be wary about future reimbursements.
The uncertainty of these federal freezes is really going to shift how farmers are making decisions and calls into question things that used to be taken for granted.
In her first comments to reporters after being confirmed as the Trump administration's U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins said one of her top priorities was addressing federal funding freezes.
If there are farmers that are indeed waiting for payments that have been committed to them, those will come through.
We will pause. We will wait.
Farmer Andy Hatch hopes the federal funding he was promised arrives soon.
But if it doesn't, we won't be able to build.
Despite the funding delays, the USDA projects overall net U.S. farm income in 2025 will increase about 30% over 2024. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Dodgeville, Wisconsin.
Since the ceasefire and the Gaza war began, more than 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced by Israel's military operation in the northern West Bank towns of Jenin and Tulkarm. Israel's defense minister says they won't return anytime soon. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has the story.
Israeli bulldozers have demolished swathes of the now almost empty Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, and they appear to be carving wide roads through its once crowded warren of alleyways, echoing tactics deployed in Gaza. Defense Minister Israel Katz said on Sunday he had told Israeli troops to remain in camps that were, quote, cleared. He said the Palestinian residents would not be allowed to return. Israel began its operation in Jenin and nearby Tulkarm in the northern West Bank just a day after reaching a ceasefire agreement in Gaza. At least 40,000 Palestinians have had to leave their homes. 85-year-old Hassan al-Khatib lived in Jenin with 20 children and grandchildren.
They want to erase the name and the memory of the camps. They told us to evacuate the area. No one should stay here. Where do we go?
Bashir Matahin, spokesperson for the local municipality, said Jenin had become another Jabalia, referring to a refugee camp in northern Gaza that the Israeli army emptied of its inhabitants after weeks of bitter fighting.
The number of houses that we saw completely destroyed is in the hundreds, and the houses that were not destroyed were completely burned, and the houses that were not burned were partially demolished. The camp has become uninhabitable due to the fierce attack carried out by the Israeli forces against the camp's residents.
Matahin said engineering teams could be seen making preparations for a long-term stay, bringing water tanks and generators. No comment was immediately available from the Israeli military. The month-long operation in the northern West Bank has been one of the biggest since the Second Intifada Palestinian uprising more than 20 years ago. For the first time in decades, Israel has deployed heavy battle tanks there. Israel said it intended to take on Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Palestinian militant groups that have been present in the refugee camps for decades. But Palestinians say the real intention appears to be permanent displacement of the population by destroying homes and making it impossible for them to stay. Many see an echo of US President Donald Trump's call for Palestinians to be removed from Gaza, which was endorsed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet. Israeli hardliners inside and outside the government have called repeatedly for Israel to annex the West Bank, which Palestinians see as the core of a future independent state, along with Gaza.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us. And back to Ukraine now, but not to the front lines or to the diplomatic circles. After 3 years of relentless war, Ukraine is facing a mental health crisis, with hospitals overwhelmed by soldiers suffering from anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Doctors say the hidden wounds could linger for decades. Jan Boyshat reports from Lviv in western Ukraine.
Like many soldiers who've been on the front lines of Ukraine's war, Viktor identifies himself only by his first name. Though he has been out of combat since last year, Viktor feels he's now fighting a different kind of battle. One more terrifying than trenches, bombs, and drones. A war with himself.
Last year, I was home on a short vacation. The first week was fine, but by the second week, my wife noticed something was wrong. She told me I was searching for a machine gun, a grenade launcher, in my sleep. She said, "You have to live." I know she's right, but I also realized that I could take a step I didn't foresee. It's been very hard.
Viktor is not alone. After 3 years of fighting, thousands of Ukraine's troops are breaking under the mental strain. Hospitals like this one in Lviv are overwhelmed with soldiers suffering from the invisible wounds of war.
Almost 80 or 90% of them has a depressive disorders as a result of stress of war. So this is the combination anxiety disorder, stress disorder, PTSD disorder, and other stress-related disorder.
Dr. Oleg Berezyuk has the psychological rehabilitation unit at one of Ukraine's largest hospitals. No one knows exactly how many soldiers Ukraine has lost in this war. or how many have been left permanently incapacitated. But the numbers are so staggering that Berezyuk believes mental health protocols and treatments in Ukraine will be changed.
And I think as a result of this war, we're going to have a new type of diagnostic procedure in the area of stress-related disorders.
But as some soldiers struggle to cope, others are preparing to take their place. At the National Ground Forces Academy in Lviv, young Ukrainians are training to become officers in an army fighting the biggest war in Europe since 1945. They know the front lines are brutal, but that doesn't stop them. Sergei, just 21 years old, says he's ready.
I knew what I was signing up for when I entered the academy. I'm ready. My only fear is my lack of experience, but I know they'll teach me once I'm there.
Here, cadets like Sergei learn how to operate tanks, use drones, and fire grenade launchers. But there's little room for discussions about the grim realities of life in the trenches, a constant topic just a few kilometers away in the hospital.
For those who have never been to war, it's impossible to understand. When sleep is absent, when you dream about everything, when you're fighting in your sleep, when your nervous system is destroyed and the pain is unbearable, you don't know what to do. It's very hard.
Victor and many others know this feeling well. Now, more than ever, they are speaking out, hoping that by sharing their memories, they can finally leave some of them behind, and perhaps help those who will soon face the same battle. Yabwesha, Lviv, Ukraine, VOA News.
And finally today, right back in Washington, for more than 50 years, WHUR has been broadcasting to the nation's capital from Howard University, a historically black institution. The university-owned commercial radio station offers music, news, and educational opportunities. VOA's Christina Casiedo-Smith met the team behind the unique station during Black History Month.
Since 1971, WHUR 96.3 FM has broadcast to listeners across the Washington region. It was founded with a dual purpose: showcase jazz and advance the role of Black Americans. Located at the heart of Howard University, a historically Black university, it was described as a new and different venture in radio broadcasting that combines entertainment with education. For midday host, known as Sunny and the City, the station's history and mix of content is a big draw.
This is such a great part about being here at WHUR 96.3. We're a timeless radio station, right? So we do play a lot of current R&B, somewhat hip-hop here and there, but it's just such a good listening experience for if you're at work.
Good, how are you?
As a former refugee from Bosnia, Sunny and the City asked us to use only her show name. She moved to the United States and learned English when she was 12. She fell in love with radio after leaving high school.
It just felt so alive, and I just was so in awe of how what it takes to do a radio show and to do these things. I was like, oh my God, I have to be here.
The station also serves as a learning ground. Part of its function is to offer internships to students majoring in radio broadcasting at Howard.
So they kind of rotate through semesters and they come and they learn.
One of the few commercial stations owned and run by a college or university, the station broadcasts to residents in the nation's capital. Serving the community is WHUR's focus, and music is a big part of what the station offers its listeners. News is another focus, with the station covering current events and analysis with shows like The Daily Drum and Sunny and the City segment, White House Wednesday.
Where I have a really great correspondent from the White House that she checks in and we talk. Her name is Ebony McMorris. We talk about all the political things and there's endless things to talk about, especially now.
Since its inception, the Howard University radio station has served as a source of news, music, and through its internships, opportunity, covering issues and Black history and culture for its audiences. Christina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.